Welcome to Newsworthy with Norrisworthy. Get ready for some awesome.
Welcome back to the show, friends. Today we're going to do our Dr. King special edition podcast. And so on the phone from Temple, Texas, our good friend, Sean Palmer. Welcome to the show, Sean.
Thank you. All the way from Temple, Texas, the heart of all things. When you think of a place that says Martin Luther King, you think of Temple, Texas.
Yeah, of course. Where else would you think? I mean, Temple, Texas.
I don't know. There's a, you know, I'm sure people here somewhere have heard of Martin Luther King Jr. So.
That's good. Well, I appreciate you doing the podcast. I know it's a busy day for you with football. You're probably watching the Packers or the Seahawks or whoever you're rooting for.
I was, but this is far more important. Time on the Newsworthy with Norrisworthy podcast is, I would set aside almost anything. I mean, it's not, you know.
Because you have a DVR.
Yeah, and it's American football, so I can, you know. What? It's American football, which basically means by the time we finish recording this, I will only miss like two or three plays.
Well, they will at least have scored at some point, unlike soccer where they will just run up and down the field.
I don't know if you could say that about the Seahawks, how they're going right now, if they will score in the time that I'm away. So I don't know if you saw the first half.
No, I actually took my daughters for a walk, and so I didn't see the first half. So yeah.
You're a good man.
I mean, I've been gone for the last 3 days making a little trip to Tennessee with our friend Tom Wright, so I needed to make up for that and hang out with my daughters.
Good. That's important.
Okay, speaking of soccer, there actually was one redemptive thing that's come out of soccer. I knew that Tom Wright wouldn't go for like a normal football joke or normal sporting, and so I actually texted you, and I started off with a little stupid joke about who does Tom Wright like, or who should I like, Man City or Chelsea?
Yeah.
And that's straight from you. That's your complete line. I had no clue what either of those teams were and what they meant. So
well, in the English Premier League right now, they're the top two teams vying for first place. But I didn't think about this when you asked, is that Bishop, right, is living in Scotland right now. So he is probably paying much more attention to the Scottish Premier League. And he's also, if I remember correctly, he's a big rugby guy. So he may or may not be paying attention to English football at all. So when he said neither on your podcast, that may have been him saying, I don't care about either one of those teams, or I'm into my Scotland thing, or I'm into rugby.
What I took it as is him saying, I don't like soccer. Football is a far more superior sport. That's how I understood it. And, well, and maybe it was just like the nonverbals, which you would have had to have received if you were in the room with him.
Well, I'm sure that's what he could have meant.
Yeah, that's what I believe. I mean, if you saw the video, it would be clearly that. Luckily, we're not here to talk about soccer, nor will we ever, ever be talking about soccer on this podcast.
Too late. We just did it.
We're going to talk about Dr. King.
Dr. King.
And you had a blog post that came out on the 15th, so that's 3 days ago. Mm-hmm. Title was Selma, Solidarity, and Whether Christians Are Willing to Bleed. And some of the blog post was based on the movie Selma, which it's a good movie. Maybe we'll get into it. And you start off telling a pretty crazy story about your dad.
Yeah, my dad grew up in Jackson, Mississippi. I was born in Jackson, Mississippi. And, you know, before King arrived on the scene in Montgomery, Alabama, Mississippi, there was a lot of activity going on in Mississippi in terms of civil rights. And one of the early leaders there was Medgar Evers, who was shot and killed in his driveway coming home one night. He's a very vocal leader, very well-known in the city. One of those guys who today we would consider American heroes, served in the war, came back, was taught for a while. And so he was leading the NAACP chapter there in Jackson. And as things were beginning to gain momentum, there was a white supremacist named Byron De La Beckwith who got his rifle one night. And as Medgar Evers was returning home and unloading a box of T-shirts from his car, was across the street, I think in a field across the street, if I remember correctly, shot and killed Medgar Evers. And so at that time, my dad was in, I think I was seventh grade. And he was Medgar Evers' paperboy. So the great thing about my dad and growing up with him is that he had a firsthand experience of the American Civil Rights Movement.
Yeah.
And experienced all of those things that you would anticipate someone growing up in the 50s and 60s in the South experience. But he was very aspirational of a person. So he ended up, by the time I was graduating college, so in the late 90s, he finished his doctorate at the University of Mississippi. And I remember asking him one time why he chose to go to the University of Mississippi to do his doctorate. And he told me it's because when he was going into college as an undergrad, that he could not get into the University of Mississippi because he was African American.
Wow.
So he wanted to come back and kind of
that,
is kind of, you know.
Well, that's part of Medgar Evers' story, too. He tried to get into law school, right? Wasn't allowed in when mm-hmm. he came back from the military. My goodness, that's pretty crazy. So where'd your dad end up doing his undergrad?
He went to a school there in town called Jackson State University. It's a historically black university. And then later got his master's at the University of Southern Mississippi. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the thing about my dad was the first person in his family to go to college, to graduate college. And he basically went, on a music scholarship. And became a teacher at a Catholic high school out of undergrad. And then we moved down to Southern Mississippi, right down on the coast. And he was an assistant band director and taught American history. Went back to get a couple of degrees at a local university there. And really is my dad and his friends, what I say they are, they went and did what America tells every young person to do, which is to get an education and to work hard. And my experience, my youth was not the stereotypical African-American experience in that my dad's friends, my mom's friends, they became doctors and lawyers and judges. And that's because they grew up in an era and a place that told them, like, if you're going to do anything, if you're going to become anything, that you're just going to have to work like a dog to do it. So the same thing happened to all of their kids. So,
yeah. But so what his degree in some ways is saying is, you know, you told me I couldn't do this. I can do this. I'm going to achieve. I'm going to accomplish. And I was reading up on Dr. King recently, and I didn't know a whole lot about his dad. But, you know, his dad, I guess, tells a story. There's a story about his dad where he says, I'm going to, you know, own the bank, and I'm going to be the, you know, big shot, and I'm going to do really well for myself. And obviously Dr. King's father, who was also Dr. King, was mm-hmm. very successful. And part of that was in some ways trying to say, hey, I'm going to be able to make it even if you don't think I can.
Yeah.
And so there's something that's like – substantially different in many African American churches compared to their white counterparts is that it seems like the pastor living a very materialistically successful lifestyle is not just like accepted, but in some ways celebrated.
Yeah.
And it seems like, I don't know if smarter people than me have kind of put this together in a more robust way, but it seems as if that's kind of a continuation of the same thing that you see Dr. King was saying is that I'm going to be successful. I'm going to show you, even if you said I can't come in, I'm going to get in there, right?
Yeah, and that's one of the things that actually gets lost, I think, in discussions about civil rights is that, you know, and this is one of the things that my father talked to me and my brother about a lot when we were kids is the idea is like we didn't want to be like white people. We didn't want to take anything from white people. We just wanted to have the same opportunities that white people had, the same opportunities that everybody else had. And like, it wasn't, desegregation wasn't about, hey, let's go to school with white kids. Desegregation was about our schools suck. Like they don't get funded. They don't get, at the same rate. And my dad fought that one as a high school principal for years and years and years is that he was in counties in Mississippi where there were two high schools in town. And one was basically, and this is when I was in high school, Luke, this is not 100 years ago. It's not 50 years ago.
Yeah.
This was in the late 80s, early 90s, where property taxes, for instance, funded schools. And so you've got these historically underprivileged neighborhoods, and they all go to school together. And then you've got these affluent neighborhoods. And so the affluent neighborhoods have really good schools. And the impoverished neighborhoods have terrible schools. And it wasn't like, hey, we want to come over there and go to the white school and take everything that they have. It's like, no, we want schools that can actually educate us, that have the same resources that everybody else has access to. And so if the pie is this big, it's about us having our rightful share of the pie. And that really gets missed in the civil rights movement. And I think there are people both in the 50s and 60s, and even now there are lots of people in the majority culture that resent the idea or feel like there's something that someone's trying to take from them. And that was never really the case. Mm-hmm. It's that if the country, if the state, if the county has this much, why does one community get 90% of the pie and the other community only get 10% of the pie?
Yeah. Well, when you're hearing Dr. King, obviously in Selma, you watched it, what, 2 weeks ago?
Just last week.
So, oh, okay.
Yeah, last Saturday. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I actually watched it when I was still in Tennessee, which was, I guess, Friday night or something like that. The guys with Jonathan Storm that really wanted to see that American Sniper movie, but I wanted to watch this instead, and so we ended up watching Selma.
The nice thing about going with Jonathan is that when you go to the box office, like, he can get the kid's price.
He does, yeah. That's really nice. And so once you get him in there and set his booster seat up and get his popcorn and everything, he's good to go. And so I love the movie. And one of the things about the movie I really liked was the way that Malcolm X was included in the movie. And mm-hmm. the sad thing is I actually thought that he was killed after Dr. King. And I just had the timeline wrong in my head. And mm-hmm. there was part of me that was going, they got it wrong. As though, like, there weren't, like, dozens of way smarter people than me, well more...
Nah, let's not do it. Let's not hire any fact checkers on this.
No, we're going to let some guy who's read a couple books assume more about the, know more about the historical accuracy of the timeline. But, okay, so Malcolm X is in there, and, you know, for people who don't know, he is, in a lot of ways, the paragon of this nationalist movement in which, you know, we're going to separate, and Dr. King is obviously the integrationist. Mm-hmm. And what I liked in the movie was the way that it showed their interaction. And a lot of people have just viewed them as polar opposites. And in some ways, it's been understood that the media and some of the people against the civil rights movements kind of played them as enemies and tried to divide them. But what you see in the movie is that in some ways, they're both coming together. And so,
yeah, go ahead.
Okay, let's get into that in a second. But it's interesting, like, as you hear the backstories of both of those guys. You have Dr. King comes from a great family, father is obviously in the picture, very successful man. Malcolm X's father, also a Baptist minister. I believe he was Baptist. His father gets killed. His house gets burned down. His mom ends up being institutionalized from a mental health breakdown, from what I believe. And then he ends up in jail. I think he was like a teenager or something like that. And you go, well, you look at drastically different family lives and home lives and see where both of them end up trying to get to the same thing, but the way they go about it at the beginning was so drastically different. And I would assume in the same way that your experience was different than many people because of the community that you were in, all the people were educated, they're pointing towards PhDs and doctorates and, you know, terminal degrees, that you see a different career path because of that. Would you think that's a fair assessment?
Yeah. And I do think that, they both have a really different relationship with religion, which makes sense in terms of where they end up. So what Malcolm X sees is that the Christian religion is weak, right? And so that results in his family suffering. And so he rejects that as a force in the world, because if this is true, then it should be stronger in the world, way the world understands strong. King, on the other hand, sees Christianity as a force that is strong through suffering, that and is made stronger through suffering. And so you have two men who have very different ideas about what actually weak and strong is. And so you're a Christian pastor, I'm a Christian pastor. So it would be easy and natural for us to assume, hey, this King guy has things right because we can open up our Bible and show people where Paul says that love is, you know, God's power is made perfect in weakness, and Jesus suffering and all of that. But that's a very natural move for people to make. The problem is now in our greater Christian society is that we have people of all stripes and all races who are trying to make Christian and trying to mold Christian in the same way that Christianity, in the same way that Malcolm X thought about power as a power political force. And so,
you think Christians today are taking the same approach with power that X was taking, but they're doing it under the name of Christianity?
I think many are. I think if something happens that we don't like in society and culture, and we, you know, except for the fact, clearly, Malcolm X was calling for retaliatory violence if you, by any means necessary, if you felt threatened. Yeah. He doesn't, after he leaves the Nation of Islam and has his trip to Mecca and founds Muslim Mosque Incorporated, he doesn't after that, and that's where he and King become a little bit closer.
Yeah.
But
it wasn't just him coming towards King. Doesn't it seem like King was in some ways moving that direction himself? Like I think it's Cone who says that Dr. King has been assassinated twice in our collective conscience. Obviously, the second one is the one everyone knows about. The first assassination was we've kind of put him in glass after the famous speech. And so all that we get of Dr. King is the one who's dreaming of little boys of color and of less color playing together. But we don't remember the later King, who was maybe going a little bit more that direction. I think there's a quote about him talking about temporary segregation might be the only way to overcome powerlessness in the black community. And so it seems like they're kind of coming together somewhat, right?
Yeah, there is a tendency, I think, to reduce King to the kumbaya moments.
No.
And not to really, like, this is a person who people have to, he was shot and there were assassination attempts for a reason, that his ideas were just that dangerous. The difference between King and, Malcolm X and a lot of people of all races and creeds today is that King saw hatred as the true enemy. That there was this force alive in the world, and that force was hatred, and that both black men and white men were suffering from hatred. The white people were empowered in a certain way that hatred manifests itself. In segregation, in violence against black people, in superiority. But he talks about this several times where this idea that you are superior just because you are white, that's a lie that white people have to let go of, or that something's being taken from you. And so when he comes along talking about love of neighbor, he's not talking about let's just kind of hold hands and get along. He's saying that our society as a whole is suffering under the grip of hatred, and it's having devastating effects for black people and white people, and that there were two freedoms that we're fighting for. One was social and economic freedom for the underclass, for minorities, and one was this grip of hatred that our white brothers and sisters were suffering under, and they did not realize and understand that they were under the threat and power of hatred because they had been misinformed as to the actual nature of reality.
So King,
and that's where they're really different, at least in my read.
Yeah. So King is saying that the white people, who in many ways were the ones who were dispensing the hatred, were actually themselves also victims of it?
Yeah. The acting out, my grandfather, who was born not long after the turn of the century in Mississippi, finished, I think he made it through third grade before he had to go and work the and work the land with his father. And he would talk about the idea of the number of nights that they didn't sleep in the house, that they would go and sleep in the woods, because the Klan would come just around to lynch people, and they could find them in their houses, and they'd be less likely to be found if they were sleeping out in the woods. So they would actually sleep outside in the woods to avoid being found by the Klan, who would just bust into people's houses, grab people, and take them to like this was recreation.
When did your grandpa tell you that story? How old were you the first time you heard something like that?
I don't know that I could place it, Luke, to tell you the truth.
Are we talking like when you're in high school, junior high, elementary school?
Oh, no. Especially for my grandfather, these are the kinds of things that would roll off his lips when I was as young as my girls are now. My youngest is seven.
Yeah. So what is it like?
That's just the reality of the world.
Yeah. I'm not making a judgment about if that's right or wrong. I'm just saying, what is it like when you're seven and you hear grandpa say, these white people come around and they would kill us if we didn't go hide in the woods? Like, how do you process interacting with your white friends, which I'm assuming you had white friends as a seven-year-old, when you hear stories like that, and white authority figures?
Well, that's a great question, because I have no idea to go back, at 40 years old, to go back and think about how I was processing things at seven or eight. But I'll tell you that,
did you ever have fear of white authority as a kid?
Luke, I have fear of white authority now.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I'm. Okay, let me tell you.
That may be intellectually unnecessary, emotionally unnecessary on my part. But the world that African Americans grow up in, not just because their grandparents and their parents are telling them stories, but the things that they actually experience, that every time you meet, especially someone who's outside of your generation, we were coming away from basketball. My daughters are playing basketball right now. And so I held a door open for an elderly couple, as they were leaving, yesterday, I'm sure seeing their grandkids or whatever. And I thought, this couple here lived through segregation. And I was just curious, what do they think about the world now? I guess people can say whatever it is they want to say about it, right, wrong, or indifferent. But there are very few African Americans, especially males that I know of, but that when they are pulled over by police, don't have a sense of nervousness about how that interaction is going to go, regardless of socioeconomic standing, regardless of education.
So you personally feel that way when you get pulled over?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
I got pulled over today coming home from church, which is really
awesome. I'm not surprised.
I could see the chapel that our church meets in from where I was pulled over. And I literally tried to pull off the back road farther and farther so no one would see me. Side note, that doesn't really apply to the story. But I get pulled over, roll the windows down, take the keys out, put them on the dash, whatever. And just had a nice conversation with the police officer, and I expected nothing less than that. And he was very civil, very courteous, shook my hand when he left. And I had two of my daughters were with me in the back, and the girls were singing, having a good old time the whole time. There was no concern. And it's obviously I have police officer friends. I've been talking with one this afternoon, and that's just normal for me. And it's still mind blowing for probably many white people to think about that being anything other than normal.
Yeah. Yeah. I was with a friend of mine, Craig, a few years ago, and we were going someplace and he got pulled over by a cop and he didn't enjoy the interaction. And he just, I probably shouldn't have said his name, but he says some things to the police officer, none of them profane or anything like that, like cuss the guy out or anything. Yeah. But I just remember thinking I would never act that way to a police officer, because my goal is to get out of this situation with as little tension and harassment as possible, without knowing anything of the character or the heart of that police officer. But and sometimes I know it's possible to be oversensitive to these things. My daughter's best friend at school, her mom and I drive the same route. I've gotten pulled over on that route two or three times in the last two or three years. And she is this, blonde with long hair, and she zooms down that street every day, 10 or 20 miles over the speed limit. And I asked her a couple of weeks ago if she's ever been pulled over, and she's never been pulled over there. Really? So, you know, that could be something. It could be nothing. But, you know, you asked me how old I was when my grandfather was telling me these stories. Like, these stories were so routine for my grandfather and my father that it was almost like saying I went and got milk at the store. It was a daily occurrence that you just need to be prepared to manage life that way. That's why when someone like King comes along, when someone like Malcolm X, when the movement comes along, and you've got these, you've got white Christians even saying, well, take it slow, or, the change is too fast. I don't think they fundamentally understood what was at stake. And all change, you know this from leading churches, you know this from the fitness world. You know, all change requires tension and pain. And when people say, take it slow, all they mean is the status quo is more comfortable than the pain it takes for transformation, even if I think the far side of that transformation is worth it.
Yeah.
Right. So,
what's the line people say? The people only change when the pain to stay the same is finally surpasses the pain to change.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, I've heard one of the critiques of the Selma movie is the way that Lyndon Johnson was pictured, and it made it seem like he was, kind of opposing this and dragging his feet, but some have critiqued it and said, no, he actually was working the back channels and doing his thing to try to move it along faster. And so in the movie, though, he's kind of the white guy who represents, we're dragging our feet even though we think it's a good thing. We're not the racist governor. We're not the racist, police officer, but we are supportive, but we don't really want to, do everything we can to stop it right now. And I watched the movie, and they said what it was like 30% white liberal clergy. I think that was their term for the people who came down the second day of the march. Mm-hmm. And I want in all of my heart to say that's exactly what I would have done. Because in hindsight, yeah, that's the right thing to do. I should have done that. But I would be ignorant and completely self-unaware if I don't think there's part of me that would have said, all right, I believe in this, but let's just take it slowly and kind of work the system in such a way that people aren't upset.
Yeah.
And I don't want to be that guy, but I'm saying I'm in there. And I think that's where you're going with your blog is that, you're saying we need to stop averting our eyes. We need to look. And so you're talking about the blog about how you were looking at people while they're watching the movie and the horrific scenes in which people are being beaten and trampled. And we people, all people, in some ways want to turn our head when we see something terrifying like that. Doesn't matter what ethnicity you are. But you're saying you need to be able to do that. You need to actually look where you need to be looking and see the things right in front of you.
Yeah, I mean, the part of King's philosophy was that when people outside of the South saw the brutality with which blacks in the South were being treated, then they would raise up and demand that things change. And so that doesn't work. That strategy doesn't work if everybody puts on blinders and says, you know what, I'm just going to keep going on with my life. I know that that's bad. I know that that's not what I would do or what I would choose. But, I'm in Boston or I'm in California, I'm in Oregon, and so I can leave it alone. It's like, not really. And so
Did you see the movie Hotel Rwanda?
No, I didn't.
Don Cheadle a while ago. Well, there's a scene in which a cameraman, he gets it, and someone who's lives in the situation of the genocide says, great, now people are going to see what's going on here and they're going to have to do something. And the cameraman, jaded, knows what happens in the media, and he says, no, they're going to be upset, but then they're going to go back to eating their dinner.
Yeah.
That's human nature. So
And when Medgar Evers is shot, so I asked my dad, you're the paper boy, right? The next day when you come and, I picture in my mind sort of like a scene from Criminal Minds or CSI or something. There's, stuff's taped off and things are being measured. And And, you know, the next day, there's none of that. There's none of that. And in the words of my dad, I mean, for most folks living in the South, just some nigger got shot. And at the beginning of Selma, because we were talking specifically about Selma, and, you know, he was in Jackson at the time. And he was saying, because I'm like, well, what was the vibe? You know, for you were young at that time. What was the vibe? And he said, we didn't know about that until the white people from the North came down. Oh. And
say that again. Your dad.
He said we didn't know about that until the white people from the North came down. And I said, well, how is that possible? And he almost said it to me like I was the dumbest person in the world. And he goes, you remember, like on the television in Jackson, we didn't see anything that white folks didn't want us to see. And so if you didn't want people to get like they didn't. And then he went in talking about FCC law at the time and when things changed. But they didn't know anything about that until. And this is the thing, like there was someone, people had to start being killed for the nation to pay attention. And like the same thing now is true with, with terrorism around the world or with orphans or with sex trafficking. It is very easy to inoculate ourselves from the reality of the world because Luke, I don't know about you, but my life is pretty sweet. Like I have two cute daughters. I have a great wife. They go to school and play basketball and do ballet. And that can take up all the hours of our day. And why should I bother to care about somebody having a difficult time someplace else? And the answer to why I should care is because just like I have those two children, God has children that he loves that I'm supposed to, and he says that those children are my brothers and sisters.
Yeah. When I was watching Selma, I don't know why I didn't see it coming, but in the scene at the beginning, the cute little girls are in the church, you're going down the stairs, and I just see my daughters. And there's girls just like my daughters. There's someone's daughters. Those are my daughters. And when the bomb goes off, and I don't know how I didn't know that was coming. I mean, yeah. How do you not know that's coming? But I didn't know it. And I completely jumped and I thought, oh my goodness,
those are my daughter's age.
Yeah. So and that's the kind of stuff that people see and that's what they connect to because it becomes real for them. I think it was Gladwell in his most recent book, and I could be way off on this, but I think he talked about how part of the civil rights movement took off because of the photographs of maybe it was the bridge scene that obviously the reporter saw, and that's how Selma tells the story. But I think it was somewhere else. I think Bull Connors it was in his jurisdiction, and they opened up the water cannons on the people, and they videotaped that, and there was a dog that was attacking a kid. Mm-hmm. And there's something like it was a big
project. The Children's March.
The Children's March. They got him out of school for that. Yeah, that was the one. And because people saw that, that's when it became real. People got behind it.
Yeah. And Taylor Branch writes about that pretty extensively in his three-part series on King, and I'm trying to remember all the titles of the books. There's Parting the Waters, but if you really want to know about King,
I've got that right up there. It's a huge book. It's like a 4 million pages.
All three are enormous.
You should get a medal if you finish those.
Well, you can just act like you finished them, like everybody does with N.T. Wright's Paul.
Oh goodness, I didn't read that, and he's like. Yeah, probably the hardest book I ever wrote was that one. I was like, I can, yeah, that's a good one. Well done, Bishop. Yeah, okay.
So they have these kids out of school and, you know, these dogs are unleashed on them. And King takes a lot of criticism about that, saying, classic sort of blaming the victim sort of thing. But here's the politics of King, which I'm surprised, I'll put it this way, I'm surprised that more people aren't shocked by. he did not want that to happen, but he knew that Bull Connors was a bully, essentially, and that what needed to happen to wake the nation was something so horrid, to see the horror of the brutality in the South. Like, this is what people were willing to do to Black people. And that's the thing. This is what the governing powers in the South were willing to do to Black people. And to see that and say, that is inhumane. And it doesn't, nonviolence to work requires someone willing to suffer. And, you know, he paid for it with his life. Lots of people paid for it with their life. Mm-hmm. But that's, sadly, that's the only thing that truly wakes us up. Like, when people start paying the ultimate price for things is when we go, okay, this is real and it matters.
Yeah. Well, obviously, he's not just asking people to do something that he himself wouldn't do. He seemed like he was well aware that this is where his life was going. And he's not pushing kids out there and hiding behind bunkers, not willing to put himself in the open. So
Yeah. He's not in a cave someplace saying, go do that.
So in the movie, I was shocked that they also include probably the more shady part of Dr. King's life and mm-hmm. his affairs. Mm-hmm. And they work that in there, and you go, "What? You didn't have to put that in there." And for people who know the story, obviously, you know, Dr. King has had some King David type moments in his life, and they worked that in the story. They do it very tastefully. They do it very tactfully, but it still worked in. And the line is, his wife says, "You know, I know what your voice is." And then she eventually has the line. She says, "Do you love me?" And he says, "Yes." And then she goes, "Do you love them?" And he says, "No." And that's it. Why do you think they worked that in the movie? Why do they do that when they didn't have to?
Yeah, I thought about that. And I wondered if it's worked into the movie, A, because it was around the time that the revelations for Coretta were around the time that all of this was happening in Selma. And so just to be true to the actual events of the storyline, like, all of this was going on at once. But I think you also see in and around Selma King at a point where you don't get the sense, and I think the biographies prove this out too, where he's just tired of this. Like, the drain of leading this movement, being the face of this movement. And so he's at a low point. And you imagine doing that sort of work where your family and your life is under constant threat for nearly 13 years, and you reach a low point, and that's just part of it. And I think it also was part of it just to not gloss over history. And so you will have some people, which I think is unfortunate, because they rarely, you know, and this is one of the, you know, what we need, Luke, is a word that's not racism, but it's like close to racism. Because I know some people who are, I know some people who are otherwise good people. And when you talk about King, what they will say is, they will kind of whisper to folks, "Well, you know, he was, you know, unfaithful." As if
that undoes everything else.
That unravels the legacy and the accomplishments. Is he was unfaithful. What I find particularly interesting about that, and why I say we need another word besides racism, is because I've never heard any of those people say the same thing on President's Day when we celebrate George Washington, right? Not because George Washington was unfaithful, but I mean, here's a picture from Washington's life. When he was president, there was a law in New York City where if you served there as a slave for a certain amount of time, you'd be set free, right? So he's serving as president. He's unaware of this law when he comes up from Virginia and brings his slaves with him. When he finds out, he's got slaves who are right up against the timeline. So do you know what he and Martha do? They send them back to Virginia for a new set of slaves, and then swap them out so the clock starts back again. And no one ever says, when we're talking about George Washington, it's like, "Well, you know, he was a racist slave owner," you know, or Thomas Jefferson with all of what we know about Sally Hemings.
Yeah.
And it seems particular. It seems like we want to undo something about the civil rights movement that we don't want to undo about other people who were significant in the unfolding of the American story.
Yeah.
And I've always just found that interesting. It's like, well, we can say that about a lot of people.
Yeah, I think if you started to like compare everyone's life to the Sermon on the Mount, we would all pretty much come up short. And I don't think that that's to say that it's not a big deal to care about fidelity and to, you know, give someone a pass because of, you know, what they've done. I don't think that's fair either, but I do think he still did some great things. And I was just surprised. And I think it's a real honest move by the people who tell the story to say, you know, this is a guy who's a hero, but he's flawed just like every one of us. And
yeah,
I think that's admirable. Okay, so you get this line in your blog I want to ask you about. And you're talking towards the end about how, you know, we need to stop averting our eyes. We need to do something. And one of the examples you give of how we don't really engage with the subject is the creation versus evolution debates. Mm-hmm. And you say we need to get over those and remind ourselves that the focus of Genesis is that human beings are created in the image of God.
Yeah.
If I'm picking up what you're putting down, it seems like what you're saying is sometimes the way we do theological discourse and debates, it's just a way for us to prevent ourselves from actually dealing with what the text really calls us to. Is that a fair take on it?
Yeah, I think just about every serious Christian throughout history could agree to that on some level, that that we like to get around the actual issues as if Christianity is a debate to be won. Yeah. And so when the story of humanity opens in Genesis, you have this beautiful picture in both creation stories there that God is creating something. He is birthing something, our world, and into that world, he is populating people who are created in his image. And that to be made in the image of God, Luke, is so much more powerful and important and majestic than whether the earth is 5,000 or 5 billion years old. Mm-hmm. Like that is that when I wake up in the morning, very little of my world is going to be shaped. My interactions with friends, people on the street, the police officer that I'm concerned about, my daughter, very few of those actions are going to be shaped by our dating of the earth, but they can all be reformed by whether or not I believe this person I'm dealing with is made in the image of God and that I'm made in the image of God.
Yeah.
So what things won't I do to others? What things won't I do to myself because I believe that I'm made in the image of God? And that's, at least in my reckoning of things, far more important. So if I've got to choose a battle, and I just, you know, you picked one out of the blog post that I just particularly, I'm not saying that there's not a conversation to be had there. I'm just saying that I just don't particularly care about the evolution creation.
unless that conversation happens on the Newsworthy or Norseworthy podcast, and then it's important for you to listen. But the rest of the time, you can go mute that out. Yeah.
So I think that's just one of the places where we get lost. And so what happens then is we will treat people who disagree with us about any particular issue extraordinarily cruelly and harshly. We will say things about them that are distorted because they don't agree with us, but we might rethink if we actually were thinking through the idea, oh yeah, this person is made in the image of God and I'm made in the image of God.
Yeah.
And I need to treat everybody like they're made in the image of God.
Oh, that's good. Okay. As we're wrapping this up, what's your favorite Dr. King quote? Favorite one. You can pick any.
Okay.
You want me to go first?
Yeah, you can. I've got mine.
Okay, go ahead. I was just going to give you time to think through it. If you've got it.
Yeah, it's in my email signature that I, you know.
Clearly, we have to read all your emails. So don't
you don't read down to the signature.
No.
I have decided to stick with love. Hate is too great a burden to bear.
Yeah, that's great, because I was going to go with the one that hate cannot drive out hate. Only love can do that. So look at us.
See? Just rattling them off. I don't even have it written down here or anything.
Wow. It's like we can complete each other's sandwiches. That's good.
Okay. So I've got to say that we didn't talk about what's in the blog post that I think is the most important.
Uh-oh, we're getting a callback. Okay, what do we have to talk about?
What I find the most insidious and detrimental to the gospel and reconciliation
is
the modern homogeneity movement within church planting.
Easy now.
The idea And you and I both know where this started, and there's no need to go. It would be ungenerous to go back and kind of and label where it began. But the idea is, in church planting, as you well know, get a bunch of people who are already alike in race, socioeconomics, education, and you highly target those people and create a church.
Yeah.
And you reduce differences
to create community.
To create community.
But okay.
And I would say that that is not a biblical definition of community.
I completely agree. Completely
I would say that actually is the opposite of the biblical definition of community.
I completely agree. And if that's how you, your goal is to create a big community, and so you know you just want people of this ethnicity and this socioeconomic class and this education background, like that's clearly devious. Okay. But on the other hand, as there's a move of church planters who are trying to do this organic church planting and relational, and it's not attractionally based, but it's, you know, people inviting their friends and living this missional lifestyle. There also is the byproduct of people connecting with the people around them, people who are like them, and people just do prefer homogeneity. And when people want small groups, everyone says, let's have, you know, multi-generational small groups. But they don't work as well. Like, people have proven this over and over again. And so there is a, like, it's difficult because if you live in an environment in which you're mostly African-American or mostly white, the churches form naturally that way. And so it's almost like you have to do things to undo the natural course of group creation.
Yeah, there's a word, the there's a word for that, and it's called transformation, which is what I've thought I was going to do when I went into ministry, is to be about the business of transformation. It's not that they don't, when you say, like, when we say that they don't work, like multi-ethnic, multiracial.
Work as easily. They don't work as easily.
Yeah, I was going to say what the truth is that they're hard. And they're hard because we have to be challenged. Our notions about the other have to be challenged. Our notions about what it means to be generous and giving and open. But my question is, like, if the church isn't going to do that, like, who else is going to do that? And so unless we want in 40 years to have a world that is very similar to the world we have now, somebody's got to do that. Someone's got to say, hey, you know what? The Hispanic kids that live in our community, they are as deeply loved and cared for by God as the Black kids are, the white kids are, the Laotian kids are, the Asian kids, and that they actually do have something in common in that they all flow. We all flow from the same spring. And so I put up a church here and I say, well, we're going to be highly targeted to educated African Americans. Well, that gives them a great place to hang out with other educated African Americans, but it doesn't do anything in terms of reconciling them to the Hispanics that live in our community. And let's say you've got a church over here of heavily educated African Americans, and some of them have siblings who are less educated, who work closer to like minimum wage jobs and that sort of thing. And they say, well, all of these Mexicans are coming over to our country and taking jobs. They just took one from my brother. Well, that, you know, that's really different if you've got some Hispanic people in your church. I'll give you a picture of this. There's a family that I know of where the daughter-in-law is Hispanic. And after watching some cable news one evening, the mother-in-law was going on about the immigration process and what needs to happen with integration. And it was much more conservative than the daughter-in-law was comfortable with. And the daughter-in-law says, well, you know, my uncle so-and-so. It's like, well, he's been in the immigration naturalization process for 8 years. Are you ready to send him back?
Ouch.
Right. And so this is someone she's known. He's been in their house for dinner. He's been in the process doing it, you know, as some people will say, you know, they need to go to the back of the line or whatever. Not exactly sure what the language is that folks use about that. But see, when she knew, when she could put a face with, oh, this is someone who is doing what I would say what I just said they ought to do, but I also said this other thing about how they all need to just, you know, go home. Mm-hmm. And he can't actually do both, and he's got a face that begins to change the world we live in. Yeah. Not that now that would have never happened if people stay in white ghetto, black ghetto, Hispanic ghetto, and call those things churches. And so if, the biggest problem, as N.T. Wright, I'm sure, pointed out to you in your last podcast with him, the biggest problem in the church in the first century is the church. And how are we going to get along with Jew and Gentile? Like, this problem, this racial problem of different people coming together under the banner of Jesus, this is the central problem of the first century church. And it's the one problem that churches now don't deal with at all. And so it's interesting how we call ourselves the church when we don't do the one thing that the church was always doing. So that's my two cents about MLK Day. And
well, you know what we need to get there? We need someone to help us reimagine church as a beloved community.
We do need someone to help us reimagine church.
And that person is found at thepalmerperspective.com, Mr. Sean Palmer.
Well, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
See that seamless plug that happened right there?
That was beautiful.
Yep.
No one will catch on to that at all.
Nope. We're serious here. Hey, Sean, it's fun as always.
Great to talk to you, Luke. Appreciate it.
Thanks for checking out Newsworthy with Norsworthy. Make sure to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. You are now adjourned.